'cause whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you too.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces right here, right now, every day on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Dan Milstein with us. He is the author of The ABC of Sales. He's the CEO of Gold Star Mortgage Financial Group. And he's been recognized as the number one mortgage originator in the nation. He's been among the top 40 financial professionals in America for 10 years now. He's been named the top employer in Michigan for 2 years by the Detroit Free Press. And he serves as the Cleary College Board of Trustees as a board member on several corporations. And his articles appear in several publications. Let us say, Dan, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we look at the mortgage, industry today, it's changed drastically. And one of the things that caused it to change is the way that all sides look at a mortgage today. It's not the same as it was 5 or 6 years ago. All of these factors that are included in if somebody's going to get a mortgage or not. When you got into the business, how different was it then as opposed to today from the side of the desk that you sit on?
Well, Michael, the industry completely changed over the last decade. Especially, we have seen major changes ever since the financial meltdown of 2007 through 2009. As recent as March of this year, rules have changed, and the Frank Dodd bill finally kicked in. And so little by little,
We're having you broke up pretty good. Then we couldn't get the answer. Let's try one more time with that answer.
Sure. Over the last decade, the business has changed quite rapidly, especially in the last 1 to 2 years. Ever since the financial meltdown, we have seen new rules and regulations put in place, and the government is driving the bad guys out of the industry as fast as they can.
Now, by the way, with the bad guys going out of the industry, I just heard today that the Bank of America is they've been sued, and it looks like the Bank of America are going to get some kind of an out by the government because they're working on doing a forgiveness package to the majority of the homeowners that they foreclosed on. Now, it's very interesting. It's almost something negotiable where the homeowner has nothing to do with it anymore. It seems as though the homeowner is at the down there at the mercy of the mortgage companies, the banks, and the government.
That is, in some cases, that is correct. Unfortunately, the number of foreclosures is exceeding any human power can be on the bank side to process papers and to listen and sit down and talk to each individual homeowner. But at the same time, banks have not done a good job listening to the homeowners on the street and try to help them.
You know, when we look at this, Dan, let's do an analogy or an equation to the unemployed. There's a 9%+ of the people that are in this country that are unemployed in different industries. But they don't talk about the 91% of those people that do have jobs that are still making money and still handling whatever has to be handled with their finances. Now, let's tie that to Gold Star. You guys have been, you haven't, it doesn't look like you've been affected. It looks like you've been, you know, number one, you're coming across the board where everybody's falling apart, getting in trouble. Where is it that you're still stabilized and you're still there?
Well, a couple of things, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, The ABC of Sales, Lessons from a Superstar. You know, I have failed twice being in the mortgage business in my early 20s, about 15, 16 years ago, and I came back into the industry, and I had a different focus in life. I didn't put the paycheck ahead of the customer needs. My goal was the high volume at discount prices. I knew that in order for me to compete with the guys that have been in the industry for 20-plus years, and, you know, I'm 35 at this point in time, and I was 19 when I joined the industry. I knew that I had to be different, and so I had a concept of high volume at discount prices. I did not do subprime mortgages. We concentrated on people that had steady jobs and were able to put some kind of a down payment together. And, of course, as a result, when the financial crisis happened, we saw it coming as early as 2001 and 2002. And the reason being is I started getting pay stubs from the big three guys, Chrysler, GM, and Ford, and guys in the line were making between $150,000 to $300,000 a year. And at the time, I had come to the sales side from the operations side. I worked at ABN AMRO, which was the fifth largest bank in the world at the time, as a credit underwriter. And I just knew that it wasn't going to last forever. I mean, it was just ridiculous to pay somebody on the line $150,000 to $300,000. And we have diversified out of the regional more into the national level with the concept of, once again, high volume at discount prices. We did not touch the subprime guys, and we didn't put the paychecks ahead of the customer needs. And in the end, Mike, things have worked out in our favor. The company has grown in size. Since 2005 through 2009, our revenues have gone up 712%. And currently, Goldstars ranks second largest mortgage company in the Midwest. And we're one of the largest, 53rd largest company in the entire country for residential mortgages.
You know, it's interesting because we are, in any kind of a business, Dan, we are the externalization of what we are inside. If you run a business a certain way, this is what's going to happen when you get your results from what you do out on the street. If you're stabilized in what I'm hearing you say, you look for a stabilized customer. You look for a person that had the wherewithal, the ability that if they got a mortgage, they could maintain it and keep it, and it didn't really matter what the industry was doing at the time. So if you're stable, then you look for the stable customers. Now, the word selling is a very interesting word. So when you talk about a sales superstar, What is a salesperson, and if you can define selling in a way that the average person understands it?
Well, Michael, sales is when you wake up in the morning and you feel like selling a product, and you're born salesman. Over the years, I have met a lot of the sales guys that got in the industry for the money, and you can never get into the industry just for the money. You have to love what you do. Money would come with that. And, you know, my theory is waking up in the morning and feeling like you want to help people, and that's what I do. I haven't called in sick in 13 years, and dead or alive, I am in the office making it happen. I basically call myself I'm the delivery boy of the American dream. Day in and day out, that's what I do. There are a lot of people that have created different titles, you know, such as an account executive, or, you know, they call themselves consultants. But, you know, at the end of the day, you are selling, and I'm selling the American dream. I'm more of a counselor. I coach people because I would never, you know, I wouldn't be able to look at myself in the mirror if I put somebody who works at McDonald's into a $500,000 house just to get rich off that one transaction.
Okay, so when we're looking at it, though, there's got to be a uniqueness. When you train somebody to sell, when you actually get across the desk from someone, when it's a one-to-one, what is it that, what's different? What's that value proposition that you have that the others don't have? What is it that your customers see in you that they don't see in someone else, and actually allow them to take that next step?
Well, Michael, first of all, you know, one of the principles of the marketing is put yourself in the customer's shoes and walk in them. I basically examine each scenario carefully. I put myself in the client's shoes and I walk in those shoes, or at least I try to imagine what it's like to be in their situation with the income, the jobs that they have. And another thing is a reputation. You know, give or take, every single mortgage finance company, we have the same product to sell. In the end, it's about doing what's right for your client and putting your reputation each and every time and meaning it. In other words, do what's right for your client. Don't worry about a paycheck. Paycheck would come. And with this concept, look, I came to the United States in 1991 from former USSR as a political refugee with 17 cents in my pocket. And actually, the book, The ABC of Sales, Lessons from a Superstar, you know, I talk about, you know, being thrown out of the country, out of the USSR, coming here on the last day of its formal existence, December 4th of 1991, going through the projects, having 17 cents in a pocket, being a 16-year-old kid, working from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. at McDonald's, going to high school, coming back, finishing my shift, getting the jobs in banking, failing, getting up, and fighting again for the job that I loved, and in the end becoming, you know, becoming the number one loan originator in the United States. Yeah, and I look back and, you know, it's only been 19 years since I came to the United States. And, you know, I keep reminding myself that only in America it is possible.
Now, by the way, there are certain things that you picked up along the way, obviously, things that you saw that worked, didn't work, and you stayed on and you were continuous with it. But you created something called mystery shopping. How valuable is that to Gold Star?
You know, it is very, very valuable. It is very important what your competition is doing, and in order to have the best product in the marketplace and know how to properly advise your clients, it is important to mystery shop. You know, you don't even have to be in sales, and this is something I picked up while working at McDonald's. We were ordered, basically, while I was in management training program, to mystery shop other fast food restaurants, you know, to check on their how fast they turn the orders, whether, you know, whether the food was good and so on. And you don't have to be in sales to mystery shop for any business. It is very, very important to know what your competition is doing, what they say about you. And, you know, there's not a week goes by that I don't block my number and I call two different companies and mystery shop just to find out what they have. And then basically I counter with a better product for myself.
Now, by the way, looking at a culture, you know, the USSR was a culture, obviously, and you were brought up in that culture and you were brought up in a particular way to think. How hard was it to transition into this culture? Because it's got to be a 360-degree turnaround in the way that you were taught to think.
Michael, coming here at the age of 16, once again, with 17 cents in my pocket, not speaking a word in English, and I came, basically, I was discriminated in the USSR because we were Jewish, and coming to America, I felt somewhat a discrimination because I was a Russian, and I felt like I was swimming slowly in a tank full of sharks. You know, something clicked inside of my head, and I became a much better person, understanding person. You know, at this point in time, my clients include first-time home buyers, two mega celebrities in Hollywood. But you know what? There's nothing makes me more happy and exciting when I help a first-time home buyer to purchase their first house, and I see tears in their eyes as they're getting those keys for the house. And this is something I live for every single day. So regardless, Russian, American, at the end of the day, I get a full satisfaction. But I have learned many lessons along the way.
My father did that around the turn of the 1900s, probably 1908, 1910. Jewish, came from Russia, and, you know, and he got here. And it was, it was a major, major difference in the culture, but he adapted very quickly. I think the one thing that he learned in Russia as opposed to here was his ability to survive. He learned how to maneuver, how to negotiate, how to get through things. And that was a talent that he had to last until he passed away in 1950. And, you know, knock on wood, it passed on to his kids. But the point of contention is that we're living in a world today that when it comes to mortgages, it comes to anything, you create your own culture. You create it in a way that those people see what it is that they're buying. And people don't buy houses. They buy what the house represents. They don't pay mortgages. They pay for whatever that mortgage is going to do for them as far as having the house, the security, whatever their dream is, quote unquote. So realistically, I think the key to selling when it comes down to the base, it's not what the product or the service is. It's what it represents to that person who's on the receiving end of it.
Correct. And, you know, I'm forever grateful to McDonald's Corporation for giving me a chance. And, you know, I have been very blessed. Once again, coming here in 1991, the only job I was able to get was working at McDonald's from 5 o'clock in the morning till 8. And then being a 17-year-old kid at the time, I would go to high school and then come back and finish my shift. You know, Michael, now going back 19 years later to the same McDonald's where basically I began my career, I see the very same people working at the same restaurant. And, you know, 19 years ago, they were complaining about the jobs. And 19 years later, they're complaining about the same jobs, but they won't do anything to improve themselves. When I was working at McDonald's, I was so impressed with the fact that McDonald's Corporation gave me the opportunity that I actually painted the golden arches behind my bed. Thank you.
Yeah, no, by the way, I can hear you loud and clear. It's the opportunity is there, even in this very confusing economic times that we're in. The one thing that we do have in this country is you still have the ability to go out and get anything that you want to get if you've got what it takes to go out there and get it. But, Dan, the problem is most people don't know how to go out and get it. That's why books like yours, you get held by the hand. You say, okay, if you're going to do this, here are the steps. And that, I think, is critical and important. But the book, in essence, condensed everything you learned in 19 years, or actually more than that in the years that you've been doing it, into those pages where somebody doesn't have to fall down. Somebody does not have to go through the pain and the challenges to learn the lessons. They're there, and they're very clear. Now, by the way, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website where we can find you at?
Yes, absolutely. The website is www.abcofsales.com. Once again, it's www.abcofsales.com. The book is available on Amazon. You can search either Dan Milstein or ABC of Sales. And also, for any professional mortgage help, my website is www.goldstarfinancial.com. We're a national company. I currently operate 28 offices across the country and be more than happy to personally take care of any clients.
Wonderful. Hey, Dan, thank you so much for being with us. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show, and I look forward to come back.
Good night. Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous
places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on, wherever we are on Dresser After Dark. Faisal Hoke with us. He's the CEO of Business Technology Management Corporation. It's a leading management solutions, software, and services company. He founded about 11 years ago for his commitment to business technology convergence. He's the CIO Quarterly Magazine. He designated him Mr. Convergence. The editors of Ziff Davis Enterprise named him one of the top 100 most influential people in technology, and is the author of 6 books, including The Power of Convergence, Linking Business Strategies, Technology, Decisions to Create Sustainable Success. Faisal, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
By the way, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
It's Hawk. You're pretty close. Better than most people, I must say.
Okay, great. Now, by the way, when you took a look at this, the subject we're going to deal with tonight, it's a bridge, isn't it, Faisal? It's a bridge to a connection that most people don't have today. We're struggling. You've got high technology. You've got people who understand it, but you've got people that have been in business for years who follow a particular business culture, and it's very hard for them to make the transition. How do you tie these two things together whereby you've got communications from all levels?
Yes, I mean, it's absolutely right, Michael. I mean, it is a bridge. But before I get into how you make the connection, let's just talk about what happens when you don't, right? So the last week or so, aside from all the political circle we are seeing, we saw Borders gone out of business, right? And it's a classic example for them not connecting with changing, audiences in terms of technological usage in daily life and their inability to put together a strategy to take advantage of technology to reinvent their business, right? And the Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Apple, they have taken over the whole e-book market, and that's probably one of the reasons why they are no longer in business. So it's no longer a luxury. It's a must that business and technology has to be integrated completely together to take advantage of the changing social behavior and the technology access that we have today. And that, as you said, is not that easy to do because we're really talking about bringing the right side of the brain and the left side of the brain and bringing all that together to work as a holistic way. And especially if you talk about organization, that's even harder because people grew up in different disciplines. So you really have to bring the business side and the technology side together and put together, just like you put together a blueprint for a house, you have to put together a blueprint for the business that connects all the dots where these different pieces fit together and complete that puzzle in order to succeed in today's marketplace.
Oh, sure. And you're talking about the businesses being right brain, the digital technologies being left brain. And one of the major drivers of business today and being able to take a look at the industries is the arrival of the net generation, that offspring of the baby boomers. Because this is the first generation to grow up, they were just immersed in digital technology, which most of us, and I go way back, aren't immersed in digital technology. So effectively, you've got to deal over the planet. You're probably talking about 2 billion people, and if you don't know how to speak their language, you're going to be in big trouble.
That's correct, you can almost look at it from 3 points of view, right? So there is these social behavioral changes because of the technology that's so accessible, and as you said, the whole net generation now, they are so digitally savvy and electronically connected, and it's over two billion people, and I think within the next 5-10 years, that numbers will probably double. So combine that and the fact that technology has become very affordable in a way and accessible. So your competition can create a better distribution channel and better outreach to this connected world than ever, right? So you don't have to be a big business to compete anymore. You can be a small business and have a global outreach of customers. So that combination of social behavioral change and next generation people who are digitally connected, combine that with access to technology and this complete economic model shift in terms of what how you reach out to customers and how you price your offering. Combination of those three things, you know, it's we are going through a major transformation in the planet. And if we cannot be part of it, we'll be left behind.
Okay, let's throw another facet in there, Faisal. And the facet is the customer themselves. Look at the access to all kinds of information about corporate behavior, operations, performance. I mean, the list goes on. There is nothing that's not transparent today. In the old days, you talked to somebody and you said you offered a benefit, you offered a feature, and if they didn't say that, you'd say this, and on. And as far as they were concerned, what you said was so because they did not have the access to the ability to find out whether or not this was the best for them. We've got the computers today, and collaboration is a major word. So in essence, when a business goes into business today, they have to take into consideration that the customer is also going to be a major part of their business in addition to those of the people that they sell to.
That's absolutely. I mean, you know, it's what has happened is that, you know, the collaboration, it's no longer just, to your point, no longer just internal collaboration. It's a cross-boundary collaboration in the sense that you're collaborating with the customer. They have almost the same information as what you may have internally. You're collaborating with your supplier. And in some cases, you're collaborating with your competition, right? So that transparency and ability to create that right organizational model and right governance model and transparency and rise above all that, that requires a lot of process-related thinking. And the larger the organization is, the more complicated it gets because you just have pulled those different threads all together in as a one node that you can function and be that value add to your customer while having the same level of information as your customer, supplier, or your competition. So the whole management behavior is going through a transformation. So it's not just about a technological transformation that we're seeing. How we operate, how we manage, how we communicate, and how we collaborate, all that is going through a major transformation. And that requires a very multidisciplinary thinking process and multidisciplinary execution process, and hence that notion of the right brain and the left brain has to come together, and you have to establish the right process and right mechanism to make it happen.
When we really take a look at it, and when we talk about the customer, we talk about the businesses, the biggest thing that I would think would be scary, confusing to most businesses today, the change in technology. Faisal, it's so rapid. You buy a BlackBerry today, and then in 4 days from now, it's already obsolete, and they've got something 10 times better that can have a more far-reaching effect. So I would imagine that a business today would have a very hard time projecting for the future because there's not the stability of what the marketplace is going to be like in 3, 4, 5, 10 years as it was before.
That's right, and it's you know, so this rapid change of technology is a critical factor in terms of how we behave. I mean, you can also argue that this change, rapid change of this technology, also creates an opportunity to be more flexible and more agile for us to operate because you have more and more ability to interact with your customer or create better distribution channel or create better manufacturing process, et cetera. But see, what that means is that you as a business no longer can have a technology as an afterthought. It has to be completely integrated with your business strategy. That's why I'm saying that you have to create a holistic blueprint. It's like, you know, when you build a house, and if you don't have a complete blueprint and you say, I want to modify the house, and you start breaking down the walls, the roof is most likely going to fall on your head if you didn't follow the right structural way of making it happen. Similarly, you have to have a complete blueprint of your business and able to visualize where and how these technology play a role to make that happen and what to take out and what to not take out. And by the way, just because all these technology is becoming consumer-centric, you know, there's a new word now people have begun to use, consumerization of technology, you know, that doesn't mean that you have to be on the cutting edge of the technology. You can gradually adapt as you improve your business model, but you have to have a key focus. Who are you serving, meaning who's your customer, and how their behavior is changing, and then apply a technology strategy that supports that process. So, for example, you know, I mean, in our case, meaning BTM as a company, what we do today, people used to do this with consulting service. They would put together a strategy. They would do a lot of this analysis process with people. We now do that with tool, software and knowledge that embedded in our software. So all businesses have to rethink how they add more value to your customer because of this technological rapid change that we're noticing in almost every single sector.
Well, let's talk about geographic change for a moment. Obviously, what you're saying is spot on. But you travel, you go to China, Japan, Switzerland, the UK, Monaco, Canada, across the United States, you speak to businesses, you deliver keynote speeches, etc. Is there an overarching theme that you have found with all the different countries you speak at of where there was a disconnect, where there was a lack? What was it that they could have had that would have bridged that gap and connected them to everybody else, because we are now truly today, Faisal, in a global marketplace. So it's not just one country. There's got to be, I'm going to use the word collaboration again, and communication and understanding between the different countries with the different cultures.
Yes, I mean, you know, almost every single, you know, organization, whether that's a private sector, public sector, small business, or large business, is living in this global connected community and in a collaborative way. You cannot sustain anymore just in isolation. So, you know, so from that point of view, everybody is embracing this, you know, this technologically enabled organization, you know, execution or business execution, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, some people, however, has even greater opportunity than others, and we're seeing this. So, for example, you mentioned China, you know, or if you look at emerging markets like India or even other places in Africa or Middle East, I would suggest that some of this emerging market has even a greater opportunity to surpass the advanced countries because of the fact that they don't have a legacy environment. You know, in the sense that, you know, a simple example is that the fact that, you know, in many of these developing countries, they don't have landlines. They have you know, cell towers and cell connections, and so they're already to a certain extent ahead of some of the developed countries who has been gradually ramping up to this digital environment or digital age. So, from that point of view, I think you know, we who you know in U.S. Has a you know, I think it's pretty established fact that we have a pretty stiff curve to keep up our innovation and be able to compete in a global market, because more they get technologically advanced and more connected and more you know, up-to-date infrastructure, they have more opportunity to compete against the resource pool that we have. And we're already seeing this. We've been seeing this for the last 10, 15 years with the outsourcing model and advanced degree holders that are coming out of this emerging market, which now really enables them because of this technological infrastructure they have in place.
Yeah, the outsourcing was a very interesting model, and one of the reasons for that, it was, if we watch what happens, it's almost cyclical. You had the mom-and-pop business. They were doing fine for years and years and years. That's what this country was established with. That was the legacy. Big corporations came in. Mom-and-pop could not compete with the corporations, drove mom and pop out of business. Corporations were doing fine. Then we went global. Corporations couldn't compete with the global marketplace, so they had to outsource. Same thing with the mom and pop. Now we see something very interesting, Faisal. We see people, because of the outsourcing and because of the economy, going home, sitting at their kitchen table, using a computer, and becoming an entrepreneur and leveling the playing field of major businesses because they can do almost the same thing. And a lot of the businesses that are the countries that you're talking about, right now, it's the creation of their legacy, and people like yourself that can walk in and quote-unquote hold them by the hand so they don't have to make the mistakes, so they can compete in this global marketplace, I think it's a great thing. Otherwise, they'd be in major trouble.
That's correct. And then, we are, especially in this country, in that context, what you just talked about, especially in this, this economic environment where so many people are hurting, I mean, we have to rethink how we're going to retool our resource pool and how you're going to compete in a global marketplace where the customers are not necessarily just here. It's all over the place. Also, the supply is all over the place, right? So we have to retool and rethink how you're going to compete in that in that kind of environment. And, we keep talking about that, this is a country of great innovation, which is true. I mean, you just have to look at what Apple has done or GE has done, which is my former employer, and other, these great companies have done. But, you see, that's a handful of companies that are doing innovation, and it builds the wealth of the people who run those companies and the shareholders of those companies, but that doesn't necessarily fueling this, moms and pops and middle class and all the people that are out there who are jobless. So we have to think of our innovation going forward in this country that has a real impact for those collective mass, like some of these emerging markets are doing, whereby the rise of middle class in India and China is frighteningly increasing, and that's why their economy is growing a lot faster rate than what's happening in our country.
And convergence is extremely important. We're starting to run out of time now, but even for the small business, it's the convergence, it's the collaboration, it's the understanding of the dynamics or the mechanics that goes on when you're doing business, and it's not in just one, it's not within a border. We're now, Faisal, we're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. I mean, you can go to the book website, which is called thepowerofconvergence.com, or you can go to our company website, which is the btmcorporation.com. We also set out a global research think tank, which is called the BTM Institute, which is btminstitute.org. That institute and the book site and the company site has wealth of information that anybody can access to learn about the next phase of transformation and where and how each one of us can take a role in changing our planet.
Wonderful. Faisal Haq, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. Great job out there, and thank you so much again.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Good night.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong. Yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're for you. Leave me. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days. Whatever you've done, it's all over.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Barbara Peters is with us. She's the author of He Said, She Said, I Said, Seven Keys to Relationship Success. She's a gifted communicator with a laser beam ability to cut right through the tangle of personal drama and get the results in relationships that last for a long time. Licensed professional counselor, her counseling style is interactive, respectful, non-judgmental, and supportive. And let us say, Barbara, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. When we talk about relationships, my goodness, in today's world, you're talking about 50 to 60% divorces in the first year. With all of your experience, do you find, and this is a question now, do you find that people have no idea what a relationship is?
Actually, I do. They really don't have a clue. They think that it's just going to happen, and they don't have to do anything to get it there.
You'd think that there would be a class starting in about grammar school to say this is what it is and this is what could happen. Or you'd have to get a license to do it, to get into a relationship. People walk into things and have no concept of what they're doing, why they're doing it, and they think because they think that way, the other person should think that way also.
Well, actually, I think they should have a communication class early on in grammar school as well. I think that would really be helpful.
No question about it.
I don't think people have a clue on that one either. Actually, I know they don't have a clue on that one. I didn't either early on, so it's understandable.
Yeah, and by the way, and who does have clues when it comes down to that? You know, you and I meet, and I don't want you to see what I'm like. I want you to see what I think you'll like about me, and all of a sudden I've got this mask on. I've got a disguise, and you're going out with somebody that doesn't exist. Then I become who I am. And you say, hey, you're different. Deep down, I'm not different. This is who I really am. You weren't like this when we first met. Yes, I was, but I wasn't going to show you. That, I think, is a major problem with most relationships.
Of course it is. I see that so much in my counseling practice. And it's kind of that reality shock that hits after all the courtship. And, you know, actually they make the... they actually get what they want or what they're after, and it's solidified, and then that's it. Now it all comes out.
Yeah. There was a show that I did a couple of years ago, and the book was about the first kiss, which could make or break a relationship. And the impetus behind the entire book was about somebody saying to somebody else, how would you like to be kissed? We don't do that. And the first kiss can make it or break it. Unless you ask somebody how they like to be kissed, how do you know? You just can't take it on yourself to know, which brought it to this. And this will move right into where we're going to go tonight with the topic. I thought about this, and I thought about, you know, if you met somebody, and what would it be an interesting question if you said to them, how do you receive love? Because let's say you and I meet, and the way that I've learned to give love or receive it is a wink, a look, a tone of voice, an expression, something. And you, on the other hand, let's say if I buy you something, that shows I love you. Well, 2 years go by and I'm winking at you and I'm looking at you and I'm doing all these things to express love in the way that I know how. 2 years later, I walk in, you got your bags packed, you're leaving. I said, where are you going? Well, I'm leaving you. Why? You don't love me. What do you mean I don't love me? Love you. Love me. You never show me. And I think that's really the problem. We don't ask, we don't know, and we have problems.
You are right on. This right is exactly on. What I deal with right on a daily with. Basis. They are afraid to tell each other what they need or what they want. And I often hear a wife will say, oh, well, he should know. He should know what I want, or he should know what I need. I'm not in the business of reading smoke signals, which is what I tell them. And I also say what you might have needed in the beginning when you just got married or when you were courting was one thing. As the years go by, you have children, you're growing up, you're growing older, things are happening, you might need something different. So if you don't share that with your partner, he still thinks you needed what you needed 10 years ago, if he even knew what you needed then. So what you're talking about is so much what is going on. The thought and the perception is not the same as what the reality really is.
And let me give you a great analogy to that, and I think this really hones in on it. When you're 14 years old, you have a definition of money, and you work with money that way. When you're 25, you have a different definition of money. You work with it a little bit differently. There's responsibility there. And when you're 50 and 60, you look at money completely different. And, you know, today, however old you are or however old I am, we're not going to deal with money the way we were when we were 15. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. It changes. You shift in consciousness. You shift in perception. And when you do that, then your world can work for you.
This is exactly the whole focus of that book. It's like when somebody says, I love him, but I'm not in love with him, okay? I hear that very often. And what I tell my clients and my couples is I feel that you can be in love forever. It just looks different. When you were in love at 14 or maybe 20 or 25, it looked one way. When you're in love, if you have children, it looks another way. When you're in love, when you maybe are retiring, it looks another way. And when you're in love at 80 or 90, it looks another way. But I'm a romantic at heart, I feel you can be in love forever. It just looks different.
Okay, but a lot of these people, when they lose the feeling, that when they lose that whatever it was that they had in front, many times it's almost impossible to recapture.
Okay. What I do in that case is I often ask them what it looked like when they were first getting together. What was it like when you met? What was it like when you were courting? What was it like on your wedding night and your honeymoon and when you first got married? And when they tell me, when they have good thoughts, when they tell me it was this way, it was that way, and I see their faces light up, I go, well, can you remember that? Can you go back to that feeling? Can you grab some pictures, play a video, go back and feel what that's like and bring it current? Because what happens is they get stuck in their careers, they get stuck with children, they get stuck with financial concerns, and they easily forget what that was. So I bring them back there, and I ask them to try to feel it and to try to see it again. And I think that really helps.
Okay,
you
and
have
then,
to have
and then
it
they...
in order to go back to feel it.
Now, by the way, what is it that couples can do so they don't have to get to the step to have therapy? Because, I've talked to so many people, I listen to so many people, it almost seems like everybody I run into and I listen to what they're talking about, they need some kind of help because they can't do it by themselves, the alone thing. People need to be held by the hand and taken through, and obviously, step by step, seven steps. You got to be able to say, this is what you do, number one, number two, number three. And that's a great way for people to grasp.
Well, that's a really tough question. Premarital therapy is around, and depending on how it is and who it is, it can be helpful. But I think one of the biggest problems with couples is when they notice something going wrong or something that's not working for them, they don't try to address it with each other. And they think that it's going to go away, or they just get too caught up in the everyday stuff and they, this will just pass. And then the days become weeks and the weeks become months and the months become years, actually. And one of the questions when I ask, they come in, is how long has this been going on? And it's amazing. I hear things like 8 years, 4 years, 5 years. And they don't actually stop it ahead of time or get proactive and say, let's see what we can do about this. And sometimes it does involve checking out with a counselor or a clergy or whatever, is comfortable to get them back on track. But you're asking me what they can do to prevent it, and pretty much it's pretty universal. If they don't have the skills beforehand, if they haven't gotten a good start, if they don't know who they are as a person, what their values are, what they need, it is going to pretty much get to this in many cases. I don't mean to sound negative because I'm passionate about what I do. I love what I do. And I have success, or my couples do.
Yeah, Barbara, it goes back to what we were originally talking about. You know, they should be taught in grammar school, but we're not. And that's why the divorce rate, the problems, the rest of it, and especially in the culture that we live in today, there was a time, you know, you said marriage vows, you know, I love you for the rest of my life or whatever it was at the time. And that's the way it was. And there were movies. I remember when I was a kid, the Doris Day movies, there was a rule that if you were going to, there was a bedroom scene, 1 foot had to be on the floor. Those days are gone. And, you know, people are seeing so much, ideas are implanted, and, you know, they're told how they're supposed to be through the media now, not through the therapist. And I think it's a very confusing world for a lot of kids out there today.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. And if they haven't had good role models as parents, then they don't see the right thing at all, and then they get very confused. If they grow up in a home where they've seen anger or yelling or verbal abuse, they tend to normalize that, and they tend to think that's what love is if the parents stay together through this. So then when they go out to find their own significant other, and let's say they find somebody who doesn't verbally abuse them, who is really sweet, who is not arguing, they will almost turn away from that and say, no, this can't be love, because that's not what I know of love.
Yeah.
And so very often they find exactly what they grew up in, because that's all they know and that's what they think it looks like.
Do we not go through life trying to prove ourselves right about ourselves?
What do you mean?
Well, you said it. That's what it looks like. I've got to be beaten up, otherwise it's not normal. There's got to be an argument. You're going to give me too much, you're going to be too sweet. Something's wrong with it. It's too good to be true. So I'll create the situation.
That's only if that's what they've seen growing up. Yes, that's what they will normalize, because that's what they think it is.
Yeah.
And even if you see a different, you know, it's very hard, because you end up finding what you grow up with. That's the role modeling, and it's very important.
No question about it. And that I think really is the key. We prove ourselves right about ourselves. And you just said it. If that's the model, then if we don't get that model, something's wrong.
Pretty much. And they can't, and it doesn't feel right. It feels uncomfortable. You know, comfortable was, let's say, the arguing. Uncomfortable is no arguing. What do I do? And they don't even know how to do it. They don't even know how to. And the other, let's like the flip side. I've had couples who have grown up in where their homes have never seen arguing, never seen any apparent disagree. And then when it comes to the real world and things come up that they don't see the same, they think differently about, this person doesn't even know how to argue or what conflict is.
So we create some conflict. And I really believe that what you're saying is spot on. And most of the problems don't come from the relationship of today. They come out of reactions from the past, unconscious recognition of something in the past that causes you to react today. And that person that looked at you that certain way, smiled at you that certain way, said something in a certain way, the battle starts. It's there all night long, and it had nothing to do with them. It's something that you recognize somebody else did that caused the conflict.
It's an old message, right? It's an old message,
yeah.
And I tell my clients, that message might have worked for you when you were a kid. Look, you had to stay in your home when you were a kid. You couldn't support yourself. But that message no longer has to work for you anymore. It's time to change the message. Take the tape out. Put a new tape in.
Well, isn't that all about your basic message? Is, you know, you shift, I'll say it a different way, you shift, well, you said it. You shift in your perspective, and you don't look at it the same thing, and the definition is different, then the world is completely different.
Well, that's change your thoughts, change your world, and it's a way of looking at things. It's a way of putting a different thought, and then you're going to behave differently. You're going to do something different. And if you keep the old thoughts, and you're going to keep behaving the way that was and expecting those same things. So yes, it's change your thoughts, change your behavior, change your world.
And the battle is basically this with communication. If you're the male and the female, the says to you, did you take the garbage out? Is it a question or an accusation? And I think that has to do with past reactions and whatever. And I think that in and of itself with communication is a very powerful tool, so you don't run into those things. I asked you a question. I didn't accuse you, but you accused me, and then the night's gone again.
Well, and I get very petty with my clients, and I show that I do a lot of role-playing with words, and I rephrase that. you know, I will make it sound, I said, how would this sound? Or if you heard this from your wife, I'm your wife and I'm going to say this, how would you feel? I use the criticism sandwich, which is a name I've given this. It's given other names, you know, wrapping the criticism nicely. And you'd be surprised at how the person's going to react to that. If they hear it in a different way, they're going to definitely react differently. It's like another thing is, how do you define something? One of my clients will come in and say, you know, he doesn't spend any time with me. Absolutely no time. I want him to spend time with me. Okay. The husband says, I'm with her all the time. I'm sitting there. I'm in the living room while we're together in the room all the time. Well, then I have to talk to them. Okay, what is your definition of spending time? Well, the guy's definition of spending time is he's in the room. Doesn't matter if he's in his computer, watching his TV, listening to music on his earphones. He's in the room. He's spending time. Oh, the woman's definition of spending time is him reacting, interacting, talking, sharing, playing a game. So they're not even on the same page with the definition.
Yeah, by the way, the one thing I remember, we're just about out of time, Barbara, but my ex-wife and I, you know, when we started to break up, the one thing that we really had in common, I looked at her one day and I said, you know, I realize what we have in common. And she said, what? I said, we both like you.
I love that. That is great.
And that was years ago.
That's fabulous. I might use that. I use a lot of humor with my clients. That's beautiful.
It's all yours. It's all yours. Now, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. I have two. I have a bjpcounseling.com, and I have thegiftofalifetime.net, where both my books are. I love that. That was wonderful.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. And we can find your books on the website, right?
Yes, you can.
Oh, okay. Good night.
Good night.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
there's Marshall back with us, president of Executive Advisor LLC, author of How to Grow a Backbone in 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work, creator again of the Backbone Institute. Susan, hi, welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray.
Hi, Michael Ray.
How are you?
I am very well, thank you. And you?
Oh, you know, I was thinking about this, a story very quickly that I'll never forget.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I was probably about, 31, 32 years old. And I went out on a blind date
last
one
week.
Night. Yeah, that was about 3 months ago. And
good,
I don't want to look too, you know. And And she was attractive, and I liked her. And we went on, it was in Los Angeles. We were on Restaurant Row, and we went to some clubs and whatever. And every time I got close to her, she'd pull away from me. I got closer to her, she'd pull away from me again. And we got into this one club. I put my arm around the back of the chairs there, and she pulled away from me again. So the entire night was kind of like that. When we danced, I mean, there was 3 feet between us, and that was going to be the end of it. So I was getting the idea here. So I took her home. We drove up to her place, and she lived second floor. And I walked up with her, and I got her keys. I opened the door for her. I know I'm not getting invited in, okay? I mean, we know this is not going to happen.
Right.
So
right.
She reaches up to kiss me goodnight, and I started to, and I backed up. I looked at her, and I said, I don't think so. And I turned around, and I walked away. And I'm going down the steps, and I've got this smirk on my face like, I got you, right? Mm-hmm. About the third step from the bottom, I tripped, Susan, fell right on my whatever, and you can hear the crash all over the court, and all I could hear was laughter as the door closed. So I
love it.
I will never do that again. I learned by my mistakes.
Well, but what story did you end up telling yourself about that particular mistake? That's
watch funny. Last. Wait. Watch your last step. No, the story. What I learned from that. Be careful of how you end something, because it could come back and bite you.
Yeah.
Don't just do something out of what do I want to say?
Spite.
Revenge, not the word, but just don't do something to show that you're bigger and better.
Yes. Well, yeah, and I love the whole notion of making mistakes. I think is a powerful, powerful thing to consider and talk about tonight. And because mistakes can really be very powerful teachers, or they can trap us for a very, very long time. And the phrase that I want to talk about tonight is one that actually my daughter, who's now 28, said to me when she was 8 years old.
How can that happen? You're only 2 years older than that.
I know. Well, it's like you were 31 last week, and I'm working on, maybe 31 myself. Anyway, she was 8 years old. I had come home from work, and I was ranting and raving about a guy that just wasn't getting it and just wasn't responding, and we had sent him to an industrial psychologist and really working with this guy. And he just wouldn't do what we asked him to do, and we couldn't figure out why. So I'm going on and on, and we're sitting on the living room floor eating popcorn the whole while. My daughter turns to me at age 8 and says, Mom, acknowledge and move on.
Great. I love her.
I bust a gut laughing at her. I stared at her in amazement, but I thought, what an absolutely brilliant bit of advice. Acknowledge and move on. And then I thought, she must have heard that on TV. There's no way she could come up with that. But I've never forgotten it. 20 years ago, I have never forgotten the phrase, acknowledge and move on. And I think it is one that is so powerful when we start thinking about ruminating on mistakes we've made. And what I love about it is it's a two-step process. Acknowledge the reality, acknowledge what happened, acknowledge the situation, and then decide how you're going to move forward. So acknowledge first and move on, which is very different than making a mistake and blowing it off, pretending it didn't happen, or blaming somebody else, right? So that first acknowledge piece is an ownership piece. And when we think about mistakes, we say, okay, well, so how do I typically respond to mistakes? Well, some I can blow off. Some, okay, well, I look like an idiot, but, people know me now, and that's, I don't worry about it too much. But what I'm interested in is the stories that we construct when we make a mistake that has, greater implication than, somebody laughed at the top of the stairs when you fell down. It's like, okay, that's fine. But, you can get over that in 6 months or so.
Yeah, well, no, 4 or 5 years, yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go. But what I'm interested in is the mistakes we make that become part of our identity when we don't even realize that that's what we're doing. And so I want to talk about that for a little bit. But then I also want to spend some time talking about the phrase, we've all heard it, we've all been advised to do it, forgive and forget.
Yeah, right.
And I was talking with a group of women earlier this week, and one woman said, we were talking about, I think, just this whole notion of forgiveness. And she said, I really don't like that advice, forgive and forget. She said, I don't want to forget. I don't want to forget how it felt.
I don't want to forget the lesson. I don't want to forget what was done to me, because I don't want to fall victim to that mistake again. And we got talking about, you know, when you don't forgive another person and it's really acrimonious and, you know, particularly, you know, as you're ending a relationship, people get angry and hurt, and we think, okay, I'll forgive you, you SOB, but I'm never going to forget this. And what we don't recognize is that we're really not forgiving when we decide we're not going to forget. The only one we're hurting is ourselves, because that person who has decided the relationship is over is gone. And we'll go do whatever he or she wants to do, whether you come to grips with it or not. So holding the anger and not forgiving and not forgetting is only self-inflicted injury. But I appreciated what you said. I don't want to forget the feeling. I don't want to forget the lesson. I don't want to forget, because I never want this to happen again. So we got to a point where we said, okay, what about if we talk about forgive and release? Forgive what happened and release the person who did it and release yourself. Keep the lesson, but release the event, release the person, release whatever has happened. And if you think about that, it is the same sort of emotional construct as acknowledge and move on. Acknowledge what happened. Acknowledge your hurt, acknowledge your sadness, acknowledge your, it's grieve basically, but acknowledge the reality that now exists and decide what you want to do next.
Can I give you a little different take on the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you shift the way that you think about it, you know, people, you know, I've talked about purpose many times. If you have a particular purpose, and then you start to think a little different, your purpose changes, and the things that bothered you on the old purpose don't exist anymore because you're not there anymore.
I believe
this right from my guts, that nobody does anything to you. You bring it to yourself to learn that lesson, whatever that lesson is that we first started talking about. It doesn't matter to what degree. We are so powerful. Try closing your eyes. The lights go out all over the world, okay? It's dark.
So we
are so powerful. You draw to you who you need to show yourself.
Yeah.
And you got to clear it or don't clear it. So when you don't have that need to prove yourself right about yourself, beat yourself up or do whatever the case may be, you don't draw that. And when you experience and you get what the lesson was, it's not forgive and forget. It's like, okay, so what? It's the total release, because there's nothing to release. You're moving into a different realm of consciousness at that point.
And I think that's, yes, I agree with you. But I think it's very, very difficult for most people to get there in the midst of the pain of a mistake,
yeah.
Whether it is, you know, whether it's relationship, whether it's, you know, you failed a test, whether it's, you know, you crashed your car, whether it's you lost a business, whatever that mistake is, it becomes very, very difficult to move through that to a new purpose, to a new level of consciousness when your identity is tied to it.
Sure.
And in many cases, and, you know, we see this, I love what's going on in the political arena right now, because I think it's an absolutely wonderful example of the power of acknowledge and move on. You know, the people who squawk, oh, my God, have we learned anything from putting an inexperienced senator in as president? And then you got the people squawking about, oh, my God, the Tea Party people who got in there, that, you know, they're...
Oh, you mean terrorists.
Terrorists, as Biden called them,
Well,
or you know what, these old cretins who have been in the Senate and the Congress for 50, 60, 70 years, that look what they're doing to this country. Fabulous opportunity to acknowledge and move on. Great. Yes, we've learned some things. Of course, you have to be open to learning, and that's a whole nother topic of discussion.
By the way, Susan, I love this part. You know, the Medicare is going to be cut. The old people are going to have to run and do what they can, and they can't get any medical anymore. We're going to cut the military's pay, because if we cut the military's pay, we can save money. And who cares if we're defended on or not, and the old people die and whatever. And, okay, we solved it. Okay, I'm going to a $35,000 plate birthday party.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It boggles the mind. Boggles the mind.
Yeah.
But we have an opportunity in the moments of, oh, my goodness, what a mistake I've made, to your point, learn the lesson. And if we can discipline ourselves to sort of be with the pain and acknowledge that that's not going to pass real quickly, but it will pass in time. What is it that we needed to learn? And given the current reality, what's next? You know, I think way, way, way back 100 years ago when I was just, I rebelled, believe that or not, grew up very structured household and very good student and straight A's and all that kind of stuff, except for algebra. Oh, goodness. But when it came to scholarships, no scholarships for Susan. Well, I was angry. And I went away to school at the University of Minnesota, and I met a student radical. And I mean dump lettuce on the floor student radical. And he looked at me and he said, you know what, girl, it's you and me against the world. And I went, yeah, baby. Ended up marrying the guy at 20, terrified of what he would do to me if I didn't. So, right, little girl leaves home, big city, rebels, and now it's, uh-oh, now I'm trapped. So married him at 20, baby at 21, divorced at 22. What I didn't realize until many years later was that that set me up to then be in a position of saying, okay, now I'm a 22-year-old woman with a baby. Who's going to want me? And so the next husband was, oh, thank God, somebody wants me. And, of course, unsuitable, so, you know, that didn't work either. But the point here is we end up telling ourselves stories about our mistakes that are not true. And then we live as if they were. And I've got
one of those marriages was a mistake. You would not be who you are today, doing what you do today, had you not gone through all of that stuff.
No question. Yeah, no question about that.
Where would the Backbone Institute come from? Nowhere. You hear it?
Right.
So yeah. I really believe in my heart of hearts, everything that you go through, every beat up that you get, physically, emotionally, whatever the case may be, it sets you up to become who you are. Now, if you recognize it, you move forward. If you don't, guess what? You meet somebody, you get beat up again.
Yes. That is exactly the point. And so that ownership of what the choice that you made to be in a situation, you know, you hear it all the time, we all have choices. Well, intellectually we get that. But when the choice is difficult or painful, or the choice we made doesn't turn out to be what it was, we want to blame somebody else. And oftentimes, well, and it's just the stories we tell, I didn't have any other choice. Well, of course you did. But you positioned it in your mind as if to say you had no other choice. So it gets tricky unless you can learn the skill, really, of acknowledge and move on. What it does is really fuels your confidence to say, okay, you know what, I don't necessarily know everything that's going to happen to me going forward, and I'm certainly going to make additional mistakes. I'm good with that. I'm okay with that. I know how to learn from them. What a tremendous confidence builder. Versus so many now stuck in this, what's going to happen to me? Oh, my God, I'm never going to get a job again. My health care is going to be cut. You know, my Social Security, I'm not going to have it when I get to be blah, blah, blah. Acknowledge and move on.
But, Susan, it's got to do with known and unknown. I don't know if I walk down the street tomorrow, some guy's going to look at me and smack me in the nose. I don't know.
Right.
But what I do know is it's not an unknown because I know how I'll handle it. I'll bleed or I'll fight back, one of the two. It doesn't matter. But the point of contention is if you there's no such thing as the unknown. Situations may come up that you weren't aware of going to come up. But if you begin to know yourself, which is that's what you're talking about, you know what you'll do when the time comes. And if you know that, you're not stuck and the strength is there.
That's right. And the learning, the knowing self, comes from making the mistakes.
Yeah.
And so we live in sort of a schizophrenic society in that way. We say, you know what, mistakes are good because that's how you learn. Don't make a mistake. You're going to look like an idiot. Well,
sure.
let's recognize the reality of both of those and say, yes, I am going to learn from a mistake. And yes, I may look like an idiot. That's part of the process. It's part of the learning. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah, when it really comes down
to your point, learning self versus being other judged and other driven.
Yeah. Oh, we're very quick, and then we have to go because we're running out of time. But years ago, I used to do workshops, and one process I took everybody through, I'd have everybody there write a blame letter. you know, you did this to me, you so-and-so, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So everybody wrote their blame letter, and I asked somebody one day to stand up and read the letter. And she said, when you did this to me, I did that. When you did this to me, I felt this. And when you did this, and let her get through the whole thing. And I said, okay, let's change a word or two. Instead of you, say I, say me. And she reread the letter. When I did this to me, I did that. When I did this, and you know, as she went through it, the entire place was in tears. But I'll tell you what, Susan Marshall, they got it.
Yes, absolutely. And that's exactly, but that very structured, purposeful, let's walk through this and let's change the perspective here and let's own it. You know, without that kind of structure and having someone like you say, let's change a couple of things, people don't. We don't learn through osmosis.
Yeah, if I wanted to do what you do, I would need you standing behind me and until I got a handle on it, showing me what I didn't see, bringing the quote-unquote the invisible up to the table. And that's what it takes.
That's exactly what it takes. And then the patience and the courage, really. I talk a lot about courage with my clients. The courage to walk through that wall of fire that you know is there, that you know is going to hurt. But when you get on the other side, you're going to look at it and go, huh, really? Bring it. What's next?
Gotcha.
Let's go.
Hey, website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Susan Marshall, see you next week.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Good night.
Good night.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Yeah, no.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. He's back. We're going to talk about everything that we could possibly talk about. Mayor, how are you?
Oh, Michael Ray, I am absolutely awesome. And I'm going to start off by asking you a question because I'm right now in Orlando. I'm here with my wife, Karen, and my oldest granddaughter, Abby. We're actually heading to see Mickey Mouse. I have a date with him in about 20 minutes. But I'm going to ask you a question. You know, what do you think the most effective, cost-effective way to reduce global mortality rates in the world is?
Take vitamin D3.
Oh, my God. You are so smart. You are. This is a recent study put out by someone who I have great respect for, Dr. William Grant, who's a former NASA scientist. And he said, this is a study that was published in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition. I know him very well. He's a brilliant, brilliant doctor. I mean, increasing serum 25 levels is the most cost-effective way to reduce overall global mortality rates, as the cost of vitamin D is very low, and there are few adverse effects from oral intake or a frequent moderate UVB irradiation, which means, you know, radiance, which means being in the sun, you know. And I tell you why this is so important. Someone's got to get it through the head of our politicians in Washington. I have a simple way. Well, I borrowed it from Dr. Grant, because mortality is one thing, but even more important to us right now, he did a study about 2 years ago that if every person in this country took 5,000 units a day of vitamin D, just 5,000, the cost to the country would be $60 million. The savings in healthcare costs, because the lower heart attacks, strokes, colds, hospitalization, doctor visits, would approach $1 trillion. I mean, this is staggering. This is absolutely staggering, you know. And how do we start a campaign to let people know that we Obamacare wants to spend $1 trillion, and here for $50 million we could save $1 trillion. I mean, that partially would get us out of the crisis we're in right now.
By the way, Mayor, we've been talking. How many years? 4 or 5 years, easy.
Oh, 4 or 5 years we've been talking about this. You know, I mean, and we actually made the impact on many, many people, and I feel very blessed because of that. Because you know, my partners don't thank me because our office visits are down about 20 to 25%. They weren't that high to start with. He says, Mayor, for a few pennies of vitamin D, we no longer have people who are sick at all. So you know, I think this is incredibly important. You know. And I'm a big football fan, you know. Actually, I'm a fair weather fan, to tell you the honest truth. But I'm going to call up the coach of the Chicago Bears, and I'm going to tell him, because I have another study here, that athletic performance among NFL players is directly proportionate to their vitamin D level. The higher their vitamin D level, the higher their level of performance is.
Mayor, when we first met years and years ago, I had no idea what vitamin D3 was. Not vitamin D, vitamin D3. I had no idea what it was. And we started to talk about it, and then I learned, and I began to use it, and I experienced the benefits. Within the last year or two, I can't tell you how many ads I see for vitamin D3 all over the place. All of a sudden,
it's all over the place now. Yeah, it's awesome, but it's still, the impact is still small because no one's taking enough. The Institute of Medicine just a few months ago said you don't need more than 800 or 1,000. Well, they're off by so far. It's not even a ballpark, you know. And they're so scared of their own shadow. They're scared to really do something that will truly have an impact. Or they don't know. Or you know, I just don't understand it. You know, it most probably should, and even worse, our wonderful Senator Durbin from Illinois has introduced legislation to regulate vitamins and minerals and supplements, you know, because he's in bed with the pharmaceutical industry. They want to take vitamin D and vitamin C and make it a pharmaceutical so we can all be charged 10 times as much for the same thing.
Now, by the way, this all has to do with the World Trade Organization also. So this is not
exactly.
Just here. It's global, then it moves to here. Somebody's getting paid somewhere to do this.
Yeah, no, it's really, really, really problematic. But until they take away our vitamin D from us, which I believe will happen, because if you take a look at the patent applications, 20 different companies have applied for patents. They have patented forms of vitamin D, which will not be vitamin D3. It will be some type of pharmacologically altered vitamin D3, which they can patent and then sell for us at $5 or $10 a pill.
Yeah, and by the way, they're going to do the same thing with vitamin C, vitamin B, all of the different vitamins. It's not just tied into one. They're going to try to take the supplements away. Now, you take the supplements away, and you dilute the strength of the supplement and dilute the that ability to be able to, quote-unquote, heal the body. What are we going to do? Then the pharmaceutical industry is going to take over, because now we've got to buy pharmaceuticals. We have to go allopathic.
Exactly. I think you're right. You're right on point. You know, I mean, and, you know, the money is important. It's very critical. But even worse, at least if we'd be getting the same product, you could live with that and just go bankrupt, you know, buying it. But we're not going to get the same product. We're going to get pharmacological altered products, which the body can't recognize, you know, and will create other illnesses, which will require more pharmaceuticals to take. Unbelievable. Just absolutely unbelievable.
Well,
you know, like,
well, you said something, Mayor, I want to make sure that we get this point across, that you said the body won't recognize. Very important. Cancer. Cancer in and of itself. Everybody's got cancer cells. Everybody on this planet has cancer cells. The immune system controls it. Now, as a cancer cell begins to build, if the immune system doesn't recognize it, the immune system's job is to attack, quote-unquote, foreign bodies. The cancer cells are not foreign, so they don't recognize them as being something that they have to fight. So what happens? They grow, they proliferate until such time as they cause the problem, and we know what cancer is. That's the same thing that you're talking about with the other pharmaceuticals, or not the other pharmaceuticals, but the supplements. If they exchange it for the pharmaceutical that the body truly doesn't recognize, disease sets in. And if the immune system can't fight it and the disease sets in, then you've got billions of dollars that you got to spend at the hospital if you want to live.
Yeah, you're 100% right. You've outlined it so magnificent. You know, that's the concept of bioidentical, which means it's something that the body recognizes. And for thousands and thousands of years, it recognizes fruits and vegetables and meat. You know, the body recognizes it, so it knows how to metabolize and break it down. But you start taking things like Lipitor and all the drugs for cholesterol. You take Prevacid, all the drugs for heartburn. You know, the body doesn't recognize it. And that's why you take a look at the list of side effects. It just becomes overwhelming. You know, I'm blown away that you see an ad for something on TV for a pharmaceutical, which now has become very common, and it starts off that this pharmaceutical will lower your blood pressure. And then for the next 30 seconds, at about 1,000 words a second, they give you side effects. May cause death. It's like I'm sitting there. Who would take it? I mean, yet it doesn't seem to affect the sale of any of these pharmaceuticals.
Okay, and that, I think the big problem is, and it's what you're not doing the problem, but I think the big problem is the information is not getting out to the public in general, the public at large. And if you don't know about something, then you're not going to be able to do anything about it. And I think more and more people who learn, who understand, can actually get active about this and do something about their own health. If things go the way that they're going now, we are going to be in major trouble.
Exactly. If we're not in major trouble already, you know what I mean? Because I think what's happened, we got some serious problems. But from the health standpoint, we still have some time, you know. And I think that a great start, if every single person takes a minimum, I'm talking about a minimum of 5,000 units of vitamin D3 every day, minimum. You know, that's, I think that's a, and I don't care if you live in Florida, if you're in Southern California, unless you happen to be outside for any significant amount of time with about 40 or 50% of your clothes off. Although I can tell you when the job report comes out tomorrow, there's going to be a whole lot more people, we find out, are no longer working anymore, you know. You know, Michael, wasn't it incredible the president said he wants to put people back to work, those who want to work? I never heard of that statement. He said, all those people who want to work, we want to find jobs. What do you want to work? I mean, doesn't anyone...
Well, here, let me hold you up on this because, you know, those people who want to work, there's a couple of cases, one in particular, and then somebody else, this happened also within the last week or so, but about a month or two ago, somewhere in that time frame, there was a young African-American kid who was about 24, 25 years old. He was killed one night, okay? But they called him the entrepreneur. Why did they call him the entrepreneur? Because he had six daughters and he had three sons. He had nine kids. Each one was getting $1,340 a piece from the government.
Wow.
You hear?
Yeah.
So why work?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real problem. And it puts you in an awkward situation, you know, where you don't want to put the incentive where it's cheaper not to work than to work. I mean, I think that's, you know, it's a real problem. I mean, it's a real, real problem, you know. And that's when you take away from someone their, I don't know if incentive is the right word for it, you know, but You cripple them. You actually cripple them. That's even worse. You know, I mean, when you do something like that, I always wonder why people like Donald Trump like to get up every day and work. They don't need the money, but it kind of drives them.
Oh, sure. No, but there's a purpose and everything else behind it. But if I can go to work for $7 or $8 an hour, and I make let's say $10 an hour. You got 8 hours a day. That's $80 a day times 5 days. It's $400 a week. All right. So I'm making $400 a week, $1,600 a month. But if I can go on welfare and I can make $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month, what's the incentive for me to work? Why should I go out there?
Yeah.
And work?
No. It's very depressing. And the problem is the person becomes responsible for it. That's the really problem. You don't become. They may have called him the entrepreneur, but he didn't feel like that. I guarantee you. I mean, that's very sad.
I'm sure. I'm sure. And when you come down to it, A, yes, there's got to be incentive. B, there's also got to be that there's something called a work ethic too. Most people today, with all the confusion going on economically, socially, culturally, they're confused and there's no real sense of purpose. Without purpose, Mayor, you got nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God, you're so right. You know, well, I wanted to know, I am very excited. I'm very purpose right now because in about 1 minute, I'm about to meet Mickey Mouse. I mean, I could literally see the opening to Magic Kingdom, and I'm excited. I'll give you an absolute report on what the mouse said to me or didn't say to me next week.
I love every second of it. Hey, be good. A website we can find you at?
HomeFirst.com. It's www.HomeFirst.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Mayor, have fun and say hi to the mayor.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. Be well, my dear friend.
Okay, good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering,
off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtain. Falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. If I had this to do.